everybody. It's Susie Kurtz from Mike and Molly, and I'm going to be talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, everyone here on this fine Shabbos morning. I am Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am so excited to be talking to a star of stage, big screen, small screen, just to read some of the credits of this person. She was on Sisters, a two-time Emmy nominee from Sisters. She was in Love, Sydney, remember that, with the great Tony Randall, Pushing Daisies. Now she's on Mike and Molly, this very popular television show. You might have seen her on Broadway in The 5th of July, in The House of Blue Leaves, in Our Wilderness, in Imaginary Friends, and also even in the movies, from World According to Garp to Dangerous Liaisons, to Citizen Ruth, to, oh, my favorite, Bubble Boy. How can I be more thrilled and excited than to welcome to the neighborhood Swoosie Kurtz? Welcome, Swoosie.
Oh, well, Rabbi Saul, there's no way I could possibly live up to that incredible introduction. Thank you.
Oh, you're ever so well. Well, it came straight from God. I don't even use Wikipedia anymore. I ask God what the guest credits are. He tells me, and then I can just repeat them. He whispers it into my ear. So there
I
you go.
I would love to get hooked up to that. Tell me what website.
Well, first you have to convert, so that could be a problem, but we'll talk.
Okay.
So the reason, one of the reasons that we are talking to the wonderful Swoosie Kurtz is that she has a book out about her life, and also the life of her parents, and especially her mama. It's called Part Swan, Part Goose. It's from Perigee Books, and, well, tell us, first of all, the impetus, I guess, your mom getting older and having Alzheimer's, but what made you physically commit everything to paper?
Well, I started this dream about 12 years ago when I reread my mother's book, which she wrote when she was pregnant with me. And my dad was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II. And he was off fighting the war when my mom was having me. And it's this brilliant book she wrote, and I wanted to get it re-released for a whole generation of people who now have someone, you know, fighting and someone in harm's way in the war. So that was 12 years ago. That didn't happen. I was really not interested in writing a celebrity tell-all, you know. I just wanted to write a book with a purpose, and I'm so glad I waited until now, because now I've been on this journey with my mom the last 7 years, taking care of her, and thank God she does not have Alzheimer's. But she,
oh, I'm sorry. Oops, I
so that's
assumed.
Fine. Listen, there are so many people out there who can relate to this subject, baby boomers and all kinds of people who are taking care of an elderly parent. And I found myself suddenly in this role of being the head of the household. And parenting my parent has been one of the greatest gifts I've ever had. So it's just been an amazing journey. And my parents, both extraordinary people, and I wanted to write about them and how they really gave me the world. And they gave me such a foundation of self-esteem and confidence and discipline to go through life with. And I wanted to write about that.
Well, it's kind of interesting, because as amazing as your parents were, you were also something of an army brat. You were always moving, or they were always moving. You had to hang back with your grandparents. Did that kind of make you a solitary person, though?
Well, yeah. I think I am a bit of a loner, and I'm an only child. And I think moving around that much forced me sort of back on the company of my parents. So I can't, probably we grew closer because of that. Because, you know, I would go to a school and dropped into a new school in the middle of the school year and suddenly plucked out, you know, a few months later or a year later. And it's hard to make friends. It's actually a great, great preparation for the showbiz life, because there's absolutely no continuity. You know, you're thrust into a group of people, you do your project, and then you're pulled out. So on to something else.
Right. So in some ways, as usual, it'd be good. In some ways, bad. It's just nice that your parents were so extraordinary. You didn't even mention that your dad was not only a World War II pilot, but wasn't he a diver of some kind?
Yes, exactly.
A swimming guy.
He was on three Olympic diving teams. And he was just an amazing overachiever. And my mom's book is a lot about that, their courtship and their marriage in the early years. So anyway, her book is going to be released as an e-book on the same day that my book comes out. So I'm absolutely wrote an introduction to it. And her book is my rival, The Sky. Here I am hawking my
nice... Your mother's book. That's just...
I love it.
Well, she should be hawking yours there. It's only fair, you know.
Damn it. Yes, yes.
Now, what condition is your mom... If she doesn't have Alzheimer's, is she just frail? What are you coping with as her caretaker?
Well, she's 98 and a half.
Oh, mazel tov.
Yeah, I mean, that in itself, you know, I know, thank you. She is, you know, complete short-term memory loss, of course. Who among us doesn't have that?
Oh, by the way, who am I talking to at the moment?
I'm sorry, your name again?
Yeah, but we made the same joke.
Anyway, it's you know, a certain amount of dementia, which makes her think that her parents are arriving tonight, you know, or my dad, who died in 96, is going to appear, you know. But it's kind of a, sounds strange to say, it's kind of a pleasant dementia, because whatever pain or feeling of loss or confusion is happening in a moment, that moment passes, and in 5 minutes we're okay again. Do you know what I mean? But it's a constant navigation, and this is the purpose, really, the book with a purpose. I didn't want to write a celebrity tell-all. That did not interest me, writing about me and my career, and it just didn't, and that was boring to me. I wanted a book with a purpose, and this is really, I hope that people will laugh and cry and find this a lighthouse of sorts for people out there who are caring for an elderly parent and make them feel not so alone.
Well, let me ask a dumb question from me, unlike all the other dumb questions I ask.
There are no dumb questions.
Oh, wait till you've heard some of mine. But if she doesn't have Alzheimer's, she has short-term memory loss. There's a difference? It comes from a different disease or just degenerating cells? There are two different things?
Yeah, I think just degenerating or, you know, died off brain cells. I don't know the science of it, but it's really tricky to navigate. It's a lot of mood swings and you know, thinking people are going to arrive, thinking she has to go someplace. There's a lot of her caregivers and I have developed enormous acting skills in this area because the reality check of, for instance, saying, "No, mommy, darling, you know, Frankie, my dad, he died in 1996. Don't you remember? You know, we used to do that. We don't do that anymore. Now we say, oh, sweetheart, he's at the Pentagon on a mission." Hmm. So, oh, okay. And, you know, her sister Mickey, who died years ago, we don't say, oh, Mickey died. We go, Mickey's in Laguna at her house. And we're fine. You know, we're sort of become master improvisers and actors, because it's just better that way. At a certain point, you transfer into not trying to pull them out of their world.
That makes sense. Let me ask you a heavy question, though. The fact that you have been caring for your mom for 7 years and living with her, being so close to her, will that make it, do you think, harder or somehow easier when it's time for her to go? Because some people feel guilty. They only see their parents at the nursing home once a month, twice a year, and then they feel guilty. But you have nothing to feel guilty about, but at the same time, you're like her best friend. So
right. Well, we've always been joined at the heart, and she's always been my best pal, my confidant. So, I mean, believe me, if she had been a mean mom or not nice to me, you know, she'd be in a very nice place somewhere with people to take care of her. But as it is, we're so close, and we've always been so close, that I just felt this was my choice to have her live with me. And I'm so blessed and so fortunate that I'm able to do this. You know, not everyone is. And I have these amazing caregivers, which, you know, I'm very, very blessed to have. But, yeah, that's a great question, Rabbi Saul. You went right to the heart of the matter.
Oh, you can call me Rebbe Swoos.
Rebbe, okay.
And by the way, let's also give credit where credit is due. I want to know how much credit is due, because you wrote this book, Part Swan, Part Goose, which is a very literary book. It doesn't have that feel of just a dictated celebrity tell-all thing, or like you were just into a tape recorder and then somebody transcribing. But there is a co-author on this. Her name is Joni Rogers. What did you do? What did she do?
Well, Joni was my Sherpa in all of this, as she likes to call herself. She had a vision for the book, which I never, ever would have had. She is a brilliant, brilliant, genius writer who had a vision for how to put all of these things together. And she came up with this incredible idea of weaving excerpts from my mother's book, My Rival the Sky, into my book and showing us at sort of the same age, like when I was 22, I was doing something. When my mother was 22, she was doing this. Not, you know, literally like
right, that. Right, I get you, yes.
But she weaves these excerpts from My Rival the Sky in, and it shows, it's really the story of these two women, my mother and me, and how we made very, very different choices in life. I chose my father's model, which was accomplishment outside, in the world outside. You know, I chose to not get married, not have children, and not, you know, be absorbed by someone else, which is how I looked at it back then. And just chose to accomplish in my field and had singleness of purpose. And my mom, when she was young, chose to, you know, she met my father, fell in love instantly, and chose to give herself to this other person and do everything she could for him and then have me. So it's very, very different choices, both totally right for each of us. And I just felt I wanted to tell the world about these two amazing people. It's really a love story about a family. It's a Valentine to my parents who gave me the world.
Now, let us also be clear, though, that the book does also cover your career, your life, your relationships, etc. So, you know, people who are looking for a Swoosie Kurtz autobiography won't be disappointed by saying, oh, wait, it's just her mom's life. There's tons of stuff about you. For example, that your initial impulse was to be a ballerina.
Oh, yes, I wanted... Well, I've kind of got a dancer's body. You know, I've always been tiny and slender like my dad, and he was this great diver, so he always taught me, you know... line, you know, what dancers call line and alignment. And so I started taking ballet when I was about 7, I think, and I was, it was obvious that I was destined to be a prima ballerina, certainly in my own eyes. And I worked on that for quite a while and then segued into acting. And I'm so glad because I have a much longer shelf life as an actor than you know, one would have as a dancer.
Well, was it the thing where you suddenly a light bulb went off for acting instead of ballerina, or was there a moment when you realized, you know, I could work in slave and I'd still never make the actual core?
I think that acting drew me. I think that's where I found my identity, my real identity. It was like a eureka in the bathtub moment. I, you know, at Hollywood High School, I found this great... he was the drama teacher there, John Ingle, and he really lit the fire for me. I mean, I knew before that I wanted to be an actress. I don't remember the moment it happened, but I remember that's it. That's where I live. That's how I can connect with people. You know, when you as an actor, you make someone laugh, you get a laugh, or you move them in some way, you make them cry. There's that incredible spark, that connection, which is, I think, what we all long for in various forms in our lives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But when it's working and acting, when it's good and when it's working, that's what happens. And it's thrilling. It's like a drug. And once you've had it, you gotta have more of it.
And I think, what was it, your first scene that you did was from a Betty Davis movie?
Oh, yeah. I think it was Dark Victory, where she's going blind. And it was in one of those books, Scenes for Student Actors, you know, and I picked that one because I thought it was very, very dramatic. And I did that in class, and that was it. That was the turning point.
What were some of the shows you did in high school?
Oh, gosh, I did Skin of Our Teeth.
Yeah. Never liked that play, but okay.
Okay.
Were you Sabina, or were you the Mastodon, or what were you?
No, I was Gladys, the little girl.
Oh, okay, right, you were a tiny little, of course, yes.
You're very knowledgeable about theater. Wow.
Well, Dave tells me a lot. What can I tell you? What else? What else were you in?
What else was I in high school?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, I don't know. The Matchmaker, Our Town. You know, the one.
Oh, of course. Well, did you get to play Emily?
No. I was person number 3 at the funeral.
Oh, I love them. No, I have no idea. Okay.
Great. It's a great role.
Person number. Yeah. You get to sit up straight. This is exciting.
Exactly.
By the way, we're talking with Swoosie Kurtz here. And by the way, I am being very deliberate about that pronunciation, and I know you've probably explained this 4 million times in interviews, but it does come from an airplane. Was it the one your dad actually rode in, the B-17?
Yes, the one he flew during the war, the Swoos.
The Swoos. So it was kind of part swan, part goose, like the title of your book. And so when people say Swoozy with a Z, that's not correct.
Exactly.
Was it Swissy? Well, Swissy is not quite either. Or Swuchy, as they would say in Hebrew. That isn't even... I don't even know what your Hebrew name would be.
What would it be, Saul?
What was that?
What would it be, Saul?
I'm trying to think. Probably Sarah.
I like that you called me
Swoozle. Swoozle, isn't that nice? I like that, too. But anyway, we're talking about her book, Part Swan, Part Goose, but also I want to get to, certainly, your career, your life doing theater and movies, and some of the people you worked with. I mentioned the great, the beloved Tony Randall, because one of your early parts was on the TV show Love, Sydney. Any memories of Tony Randall, not to mention certain whatever that show went through to get on the air, considering the lead character was somewhat acknowledged as a homosexual?
Right. It was really the first gay character on television. That was what we set out to do. And Tony was very definite about that fact with the networks. Well, long before the show ever aired, the affiliates got wind of this, that this was a gay character. You have to, you know, realize this was back in, 1981, I think. And the affiliates started pulling out. They hadn't even seen the first episode. So it was a tough battle. And, you know, as adamant as Tony was about keeping this character gay as much as you could in those days, which was very subtle.
Right. You didn't see him pulling out of anybody, that's for sure. Yes?
I can't believe you just said that.
Well, yeah.
Did you just say what I thought you said?
It's a Friday night. Rabbis get a little loose. I've got 3 bottles of wine next to me. I can say these things. Besides, you say in your book that half the time you have to check yourself from turning into the character you play on Mike and Molly. So, you know, and you're always trying to pull back from the puns you want to make. So don't you be pointing fingers, Missy Swussy.
Yes,
don't you
I
do
have
that.
No right to be calling the kettle black.
There you go.
Rabbi Jewish or whatever.
Exactly. So I'm sorry, you were saying about the networks and the affiliates.
Oh, yeah. So they started pulling out, and, you know, people, there was a lot written about the show. And by the time we actually, you know, it got on the air, it was sort of watered down. It was still a great show, but he just kind of became a happy bachelor with me and my little girl, you know, living with him. But there were subtle moments here and there that, like, if you got it, you got it, and if you didn't, it was fine. But it was very brave of him, I think, at that point in time. It's hard to believe with what's on the air now, but to try and do that, you know.
And oh, yeah.
He's also adamant about the fact that it be shot in New York.
I think in the final episode, he shoots Harvey Milk, which was a big shock. I was not expecting that at all. But do you have any Tony Randall story? Because he's such a wonderful eccentric, or he was, and such a delight. Everybody I've ever talked to who worked with him or met him has a Tony Randall story.
Well, he's great. I mean, we got along great, and I wasn't afraid to speak up to him when he would misbehave.
How would Tony Randall misbehave?
Well, he would get kind of childlike about something, or childish, and he wouldn't literally stamp his foot, but he would be like, I don't understand why we can't have it that way, you know, and when it was something that I could be involved with, I mean, if he was talking to the network, I didn't get
it. Sure, yeah.
You know, I would just turn, I'd say, Tony, come on now, you're acting like a child, and he would say, you're right, I'm sorry.
And I can see him doing that, too.
He was so connected because he was such a lover of theater. And we had all these amazing guest stars, like, you know, that he knew, that were friends of his from the opera and the ballet, Suzanne Farrell and Yitzhak Perlman, and I think we had Betty White on, and these amazing guest stars. Just, you know, very cultured for a sitcom.
Well, speaking of culture and an amazing other person that you've worked with, let's move to a totally different thing, to a movie you were in, starred in, co-starred in, called A Shock to the System with Michael Caine. I wish I could do an impersonation of him, but I can't. But any Michael Caine stories?
Well, you know, I fell completely in love with him, madly. He's never known that to this day, but he is just the greatest person. He's one of those 10 that you want on the desert island for sure. And he, there was a, with the first reading of the script, there was, you know, you sit around and you read it so the writers can hear it, and then they go back and work on it. And there was this one actress who kept stopping before almost every scene, every line, and she'd go, I don't understand why I get so angry with him in this scene, because in the last scene I've just been blah, blah, blah. She goes on and on. Every time she would stop the reading, instead of just, you know, just committing to it and let the writers hear it. And finally she asked her a question. Michael went very sweetly, very gentlemanly, but he said, "Darling, it will all be revealed at the premiere."
Oh, very nice. And did it work? Did it shut her up?
It kind of did. I think she got it. And to this day, I use that line in my everyday life.
That's why I use the line, "You were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off," you know, usually in sermons and stuff.
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, I don't do it in his voice. I do it in mine, which just scares the parishioners silly. I don't even know why I do it. But anywho, we're talking with Swoosie Kurtz about the things that she's done. Oh, my God, there's so many more to talk about. For example, you were in the movie Wildcats with Goldie Hawn, nice Jewish lady. What was it like working with her?
I loved Goldie. She had it totally together as a movie. She knew how to be a movie star. You know, I mean, she had her snacks together. She paced herself for those long shooting days. And she was fearless. I mean, she was playing this high school football coach, and she would get out there in this Chicago weather. I mean, it was March or something, but it was still brutal. And be on the football field with all these young guys, and she had us all doing aerobics at lunchtime.
I'm surprised you didn't smack her.
Oh, I'd much rather eat. But Goldie was. I really idolized her. She's great.
Good.
That would be great.
Good. Okay. I'm trying to get some memories and some thoughts of people. For example, also, you were on Broadway in a play by Nora Ephron. She passed away recently. She just had the show Lucky Guy on Broadway. But you were in a show called Imaginary Friends, and it was a premiere. So was she working on it? Did you meet her a lot? Did you work? Did she come to you with new pages every other day? How did that go?
Oh, yes. Nora became one of my dear friends, and I became a friend of hers, which I am forever blessed. Nora was one of the great, great gifts in life. We worked on the play to begin with in San Diego, and then we moved to Broadway. And I was playing Lillian Hellman, and the magnificent one and only Cherry Jones was playing Mary McCarthy.
Right.
And it was about their feud, those two great writers. And oh, my God, we had a blast. We had an absolute blast. We went to Broadway. We didn't run long enough, but it was just a great experience playing Lillian Hellman. I had met Hellman once years and years before that when I was doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Mike Nichols and Elaine May, of all people.
Whoa!
I know. And the world was coming to see this, and Richard Avedon, the great photographer, brought Lillian Hellman, and I found myself sitting across from Lillian Hellman at this dark cocktail lounge after the play. And she said in that gravelly voice of hers, she said, "Oh, darling, your facial expressions, your nuances were fantastic. Where's my vodka?"
Well, at least she complimented you before she asked for the vodka.
Yes, exactly.
That's a good thing. Did you by any chance see the off-Broadway play they just did about the Hellman-McCarthy feud?
Oh, what? I know about it very well because a friend of mine was in it.
Well, Dick Cavett?
No, I know Dick Cavett, but this was Jeff Woodman, a friend of mine, was one of the people in it. And he said he's got war stories about it, which I can't wait to hear when I get to New York. And I thought it just sounded fascinating because I just love that story of this two women feuding.
Absolutely. And let's see, because we don't have that much time with Swoosie Kurtz, but I'm going to ask all these other questions. For example, did your life kind of change when you won either an Emmy or a Tony Award? You feel a bump, no question. The agents call more or whatever. Does it make a huge difference, or is it, like, momentary?
You know, you think, you're right, it's definitely a bump, and you feel like this is going to change my life and my career. I remember the first time I was nominated for an Emmy, I thought, oh, my God, well, this is just a hook and be a hold. And it really isn't. I mean, let's face it, it means more to you yourself, I think, than it does to the rest of the world. I mean, if winning the Tony, certainly, which I've been be able to have two of them is incredible, and just being nominated is incredible. But I certainly think with Oscars, probably it does change your external life, but it doesn't, you know, none of that stuff really changes you inside.
Okay.
You know, how people look at you. You really have to, you got to love yourself inside, and that's one of the things my parents imparted to me. You know, because the external changes, you can't really control it.
And for you, the external changes is, thank God you've done a lot of TV, a lot of sitcoms, which is giving you a comfortable living, as opposed to, even with winning Tonys, Broadway is not necessarily the way for even someone famous to make a living. There's a joke that you made when you were doing Heartbreak House on Broadway. Was it on Broadway, or maybe it was not?
No, you're correct. It was on Broadway, and a friend of mine in the cast, we sat down one night, because it's such a long play, you know, it's Shaw, so it's like over 3 hours and three long acts, and we sat down one night and tried to figure out how much we were being paid, because it's institutional theater, you know, it was the Roundabout, so, which is, does beautiful and fabulous productions on Broadway, but you know, there's just a certain, everybody gets paid the same thing, and it's not very high, and we figured out that deleting commissions, and, you know, to your manager, your agent, and so forth, and everything, we were being paid $26.25 per act.
Which is, and Shaw's acts are longer than an hour. So you're basically making $20 an hour for your actual stage time.
Right, right.
And I think you even made the joke that you should have called it Abu Hirab Rep.
Yes, exactly. Because they give you just enough food and water to subsist for 8 performances a week.
That's right. Well, let me ask you, does that get harder as you, I mean, you're not an old lady, but as you get older, does 8 shows a week sound more and more daunting if you go back to do theater as opposed to just doing TV?
It definitely does.
Does it?
Oh, my God, yes. Because that 8 shows a week, it sounds like, I'm sure people think, well, you're on stage for 2 or 3 hours a night, what's the big deal, you know? But it's not. It's 8 times a week. It's exhilarating and exhausting, but boy, you got to give more than 100% each time, and you want to, because each audience is there, they've never seen it before, you know, you want to do it, you want to come up to that bar every time, but boy, it's being on some kind of treadmill, but I mean, I love it once I get into it, but it's a life-swallowing project, and film and television is longer hours per se, but you have breaks, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, they're not shooting any of my scenes today. I have a day off.
Oh, that helps. That helps a lot, especially if you are doing a 16-hour day, let's say, in front of audiences, and you do... Mike and Molly do 2 separate shows, and they cut the best takes?
Is it? You know what we do? We do one show in front of the live audience once a week, and we do some pre-shoots the day before. If there's a difficult scene where there's a stunt or an animal or somebody gets, you know, splashed with water or covered in something and they have to be cleaned up, we do that the day before.
I do that for my Sagers, yeah.
Yeah, you know the drill. And then the next day, when we bring in the live audience, we just do one show, but we do several passes of each scene. So we'll just take a scene and we'll do, you know, 2 passes, 4 passes, whatever it takes to get that scene right, and then we move on to the next.
That makes sense. And then compared to other sitcoms that you have been in or TV programs, is it easier, harder, about the same now that they shoot on video things, now that they pre-shoot stuff? What?
I don't know if that makes a difference to my side of it, really. I don't see a difference, honestly.
Okay.
It's just they do have, you're right, I mean, they do have a lot of stuff figured out, so it's a little smoother. But like things they can fix in post, you know, they always say, oh, we'll fix it in post, meaning post-production. Like if you have a hair sticking straight up on top of your head, don't worry, we'll fix it in post.
So they can just airbrush it right out through
like
technical.
Yeah, like have a big pimple on your face or something, don't worry.
All right. That's, and by the way, one of the credits that I forgot to even mention when I was running off and rattling these things off is that you won the Emmy Award for a show called Carol and Company, which was a post-Carol Burnett show. Carol Burnett show. Any memories of that and any thoughts on Carol?
Oh, Carol was so great. They wrote this incredible script for me, which, you know, most scripts you get and you go, well, I got to visualize this with a little work on it. you know, and it needs work. This was something that's rare, set in your lap, perfect. It was perfect finished product. It was about Carol and I had gone to high school together, but she had had a sex change since then. In high school, she was the star quarterback, and we were an item.
Okay.
Had a sex change, left, and this takes place at the reunion years later, and I have, you know, I'm kind of trailer trash, and I'm kind of a heavy drinker, and I've never left, I've never moved on, and I hold this bitterness for her, and she says, well, you don't understand, I was two different people back then, and I say, well, one of them should have called.
Unfortunately, that season only lasted, that show only lasted one season, but did you love working with her?
Yeah, I mean, I was just on that one episode as a guest star.
Right, so.
She is so, what a beautiful person she is on stage and off, and she gave me that gorgeous quote for the back of my book, so such a generous.
Well, I might as well read it here. It's a long one. I laughed and cried sometimes at the same time. Reading this extraordinary story about Swoosie and her parents and her work and her loves, Swoosie has the beautiful gift of a seasoned storyteller. I feel blessed to know her. That's from Carol Burnett on the back cover of Swoosie Kurtz's book with Joni Rogers, Part Swan, Part Goose, available from Perigee Press. And by the way, another thing that I think I mentioned that you were in the movie World According to Garp, but I didn't mention that the star of that, of course, was Robin Williams with Glenn Close. Any memories or anecdotes about them?
Well, Glenn and I have worked together several times, so we already knew each other, but I didn't know Robin. But it was just fantastic because it was around the time that I was nominated for a Tony for the 5th of July, so I would, you know, flying back and forth to locations in upstate New York and then back to the theater in time to do a matinee. And it was just an exciting time. And we had that wonderful scene in the coffee shop where she hires me as a hooker to be with her son, Garp.
Right.
She starts giving me money in front of people and everything. And she's just, it was we shot it during the night, all during the night. And, you know, we were sort of all imbibing or something to get warm. Some of the prop guys had some brandy on the set or something. It was freezing, and we were shooting in this coffee shop with, of course, no heat or anything. And, you know, the doors are open, and it's the middle of winter. And anyway, it was fantastic fun.
Good. I love to hear the happy, fun, nice stories. I mean, but feel free, is there any dirt or mud you want to fling, especially if someone's dead and they you know, can't fight back or they can't hurt you now? Any people that you worked with that you would never, ever again?
There have been a couple of crazies.
Ooh.
Who were removed by other circumstances. You know, karma and these things happen in the right way. And I have been so, and I'm really not whitewashing this, I have been so blessed and fortunate in my career not to work with the people I hear stories about. I mean, I hear stories that you can't even believe about the way people who get a little bit of power then proceed to behave. I have not come across it except once or twice, and it has not been directed at me.
Oh, but you witnessed it, but at least it wasn't coming straight at you, which is, I guess,
yeah,
helpful. Yeah,
I think some of the choices I've made, too, have been good of the people I work with, because I love working with grown-ups. I love working with people who operate from a base of security and love and not fear and insecurity.
Is there anybody like that in Hollywood? I mean, really?
Really? What am I saying?
And also one thing I want to say about Swoosie Kurtz's book is, again, it's not, as you say, it's a story of love and your parents' journey and your journey. It's not this tell-all gossipy book, but you do come clean about certain things, and you make clear that even though you are not married and have never been married, it's not that you're crazy or weird or a shut-in or a lesbian. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Some of my best friends and some of my favorite porn actresses are lesbians. But the point is that it's just your way. You made the career your path, but you have had relationships. And you talk about Joshua White in the book, fairly early on in the book, who got you to Woodstock in a strange way.
In a strange way. Yes, he was the Josh White that's, for those who remember, are old enough or have heard about the Joshua Light Show, which was a real breakthrough, legendary light show. He did the drop the liquids into the, you know, the project that would be projected on the screen behind Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and the Doors and all these major musical acts at the Fillmore East in New York. This was like late 60s, early 70s. And he created this system for making all these amazing liquid projections. And of course, everyone in the audience was stoned out of their minds, except Josh and me.
You were working the board. You had to be compass mentis, yeah.
It's great, you know. But Josh really, he was incredible graphic artist and photographer and all that. And I was on tour. I would have been with him at Woodstock with the Joshua Light Show. I would have been right there in the thick of it. Had I not been on a tour with Betsy Palmer of the Prime of Miss Jean Brody. But Josh sort of got me to Woodstock after all, because he projected a close-up that he had taken of my eyeball on the screen behind Jimi Hendrix as he was performing live. So I could sort of say I was on stage with Jimi Hendrix.
Whoa!
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
And what's kind of cool is because you were going out with him and living with him for a while, you got to see all these performing. You at some point saw Hendrix and the Doors and all these acts play.
Yeah.
I mean, that was unfortunately a bit before my available time. What was it? Do you have any amazing memories of just being at these kinds of concerts? Did you see the Stones? Did you see Dylan? Did what?
Yeah, I just remember that you got a contact high the minute you walked Fillmore East. I mean, you couldn't help it. It was, the air was thick with dope and cigarette smoke, and people were on acid and all kinds of stuff. And, I would just, you know, be walking backstage and brush past Jim Morrison or Grace Slick and just thought nothing of it. You know, I knew how amazing it was, but it's more amazing looking back on it.
Right, at the time, that's what I always wonder about people. Is that at the time, could you have known it was the greatest music, rock and roll, whatever? Couldn't you have known how...
Exactly.
Yeah.
At the time, it's just another day at the office, you know?
But do you have any memories of really actually meeting or an anecdote, a story about some rock and roll legend that you saw backstage or whatever?
No, I remember once Josh did some lights for the Doors in Toronto. And we went up there, and we were staying at the same motel they were staying in. And I went for a swim in the pool at the motel and found myself in the water with Jim Morrison.
Whoa. He didn't pee, did he?
He might have. I don't know.
It's still better than being in the water with P. Diddy, come to think of it. But, no, but so did you talk, or did you just swim, or did what?
We talked a little. I think Josh was there, too, because, you know, he knew that he was going to do the light show for them. And, I don't remember anything particularly significant, just like being blown away by being in the water with them.
Wow. Well, actually, didn't Morrison drown? So that's kind of it's a good thing you were there in the pool with him. He could have died a little earlier. Come to think of it, I don't know.
Wow.
Anywho.
Look that one up.
But so also the thing is that you as you say in the book, you've never ever been kind of a wild, crazy, loose sort of person. I think at one point, I don't know if I didn't get to this part of the book, you were dating Brent Spiner, the actor.
Yes.
Did you meet him at A History of the American Film? Because I noticed you were both in that show on Broadway.
Yes, on Broadway, right. Uh-huh.
Oh, cool. So how long were you guys together?
Well, 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, same with Josh. 6 years seems to be the magic number for me somehow.
So is there a point at which you just say, this has been great, we kind of love each other, but marriage is not going to happen, and so let's go?
Well, in both of those cases, they actually let me go.
Oh, okay, sorry.
They walked away. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happens in a relationship. I think it's just the hardest relationship there is. And I've never been great at it, I don't think. But I haven't had that much practice, so who knows?
Well, also, again, it must be difficult that you are taking care of your mom and living with her, in fact. Have you been, and you've got a TV show to deal with, and all the other things you do. Have you been dating the past few years, even casually?
Oh, gosh. I think you could say very casually.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I mean,
it's been an overwhelming time. I'll tell you, it's my plate is pretty full with all of this. I am in awe of some people that they can do. They can juggle a lot of things at once. I'm not really good at that. I'm sort of singleness of purpose was passed down to me by my dad, and I'm kind of, you know, hyper-focused. So I'm not good at doing a lot of things at once.
But the question is, you're still pretty young and in wonderful shape and all that. There's a certain point at which your mom will go, and it'll be 10 years down the 15, 20. Do you have a fear of, at that point, just being by yourself, or will you have this group of community of people that you have acted with and your neighbors and stuff? So whether you're with someone or not, or living or married, etc., still won't matter.
No, I think I am afraid of being alone.
Oh,
absolutely. I have more friends in New York than LA because I have such a, I don't know, it's just more, it's easier in New York. It's easier to get together with people. But I wouldn't say I have a huge amount of friends. I do tend to be a bit of a loner. I'm not great at communicating with people. You know how some people are great at keeping in touch all the time? I'm really not great at that. I mean to be in my heart. I really do, but I'm not great at it. So definitely, I definitely thought about that.
You know what you need to? You need to send out Jewish New Year cards. Works every time. Get 300 people on your list, send out the cards, you'll see. You'll say, it'll come back to you in good karma.
Well, now, Rabbi Saul, are you married? Are you available? Let me put it that way.
Oh, that's so sweet of you to ask.
Right,
but
to the point.
My dear wife, Miriam Libby, and I have 21 and a half beautiful children.
Oh, God.
Well, actually, 15 are beautiful. The rest, there's inbreeding problems. But yes, we are still together. However, for, you know, what happens in Vegas, or for me, Detroit, stays
right.
In. So if you're ever in Detroit...
Oh, yeah. I'm just saying, I mean, you're my kind of guy. I love Jewish men.
Oh! Yeah.
There you go. Most of the men I've been involved with and have worshipped have been Jewish. So not even by... just by chance, you know?
Well, Michael Caine isn't Jewish, but okay, you got Joshua White.
Well, but that was professional, you know.
Was Brent Spiner I guess he is.
Yeah.
Yay! I wonder what his Hebrew name is. Jessica. And who else? Are there any other people that we would know that you dated seriously or semi-seriously? Just curious.
Not that you would know. No, not that you would know.
Okay.
I have to keep some mystery, you know.
Absolutely. Although, the wonderful thing about your book is you don't tell anything. You tell the whole truth, the unvarnished truth, but not salaciously, not in a mean way. And plus, you have these stories to tell both about you and your parents. What is your favorite childhood memory, Swoosie Kurtz?
I have so many, because my parents gave me this incredible childhood. I just felt such support and enthusiasm. Whenever I would want to go, like when I was little, well, not that little, but just barely into my teens, I desperately wanted to go and see Tommy Edwards, who had this big hit, It's All in the Game. And I would play that 45 record over and over and over until it was worn out. We were on
Many a Tear Has to Fall, but it's that song?
Bad Many a Tear Has to Fall.
Right.
We were going across the country in the car, as we were so much of my life, to some new place to live. And I read somewhere that he was playing at this theater right outside Chicago. And I said, you know, that's not too far from our little route that we're on here, in my 7-year-old voice, or what, 10-year-old, whatever it was. And they figured it out. We tracked down the theater, and we stood out like crazy. These two really white people with their skinny little white princess in what was kind of the Apollo, you know, type of theater outside Chicago. And it was so wonderful. I mean, I'll never forget that, seeing him in person. And they took me backstage to meet him, and then, you know, them taking me to the Ed Sullivan Show, and taking me to see Elvis on television.
Wait. Were you in the studio audience for Elvis, or were you watching at home on TV?
No, we were going in the car across
the
country, and they stopped at this motel and talked to people in the lobby into turning it to the Ed Sullivan Show so I could see it. But I did go to the Ed Sullivan Show with my mom. And
who was on the Ed Sullivan Show when you were there?
Oh, you know, the guy who did the puppets.
Senor Winches?
Yes.
Whoa!
And then Rocky Graziano was in the audience, and you know how he would have people stand up. Well, you probably don't because you're too young, but he actually had us stand up. He introduced us and had us stand up.
Because your dad was the Olympian, or why?
Yeah, and the war hero.
Right, oh, okay.
So it just, we, you know, these things that they, I just always remember when I said, oh, I'd love to do this, or I'd like to have that, or why don't we do that? There was never an attitude of, not interested in that. Let's do that later. It was always like, okay, how can we make this happen? Let's get tickets. Let's, you know, let's go to the Hollywood Bowl for Easter sunrise service or whatever. You know, it was just this amazing collection of yeses, you know. Yes, let's do that. Let's make that happen. How can we make that happen? So it was just great.
Life is meant to be experienced, not watched from afar.
Right.
Would kind of be the thing. And I think it's been a wonderful experience talking with the delightful, funny, swoosy Kurtz. If you want the full-on swoosy experience, by all means, please get her book, co-written with Joni Rogers, Part Swan, Part Goose, An Uncommon Memoir of Womanhood, Work, and Family from Perigee Books. And also, of course, watch her on TV in the new season of Mike and Molly. Are you in syndication territory? How many seasons has that been on?
That's so funny you would say that. We start in syndication in the fall.
Mazel tov. That's when it really, oh boy, you are sitting pretty now. What is it, 99 episodes they have to have? And that's the golden goose kind of thing?
Yeah, we've got 92 so far, and we're going into our fifth season, so it's just incredible.
Mit mazel. What's the funniest thing that's happened on or off the set of that show?
Well, this isn't really funny, but it was memorable.
Oh, how many people died? No, just, okay, what?
one night, James Burrows, who was our director for the first two seasons, is this legendary, you know, he did Friends and Taxi and
right.
Cheers and all these amazing shows. And he just knows everybody, and everybody loves Jimmy. And he had a guest there one night, and we were doing scenes in front of a live audience, and then he said, oh, Swiss, come on over here. I want you to meet somebody. And I just about faded dead on the spot. It was Bruce Springsteen.
Wow.
I know.
And
I couldn't have been nicer. Like, I didn't wash my hands the rest of the night. Right hand.
Well, let me ask you, if you're a fangirl, as I sometimes am a fangirl, are you able to ask for autographs of these kinds of people, or do you have to be really cool, like a star, and know that, oh, no, that would be in bad taste?
I've never really understood the whole autograph thing. I mean, I think I wanted them a little bit when I was a little girl, but I didn't really, I don't understand. I sort of understand photographs now. There's so many times, especially writing this book in my life, that I've thought, oh, God, I wish I had a picture with him or her. You know, why didn't I think of that?
Right.
Well, I'm trying to, from now on, remember the whole... We've never been a big photograph-taking family. Like, Lifetime did this intimate portrait on me a few years ago, and they said, oh, well, you know, we'll want home movies. And I said, I don't have any home movies.
Oh, that's funny. I would figure, of all people, your father was so photogenic, and they were so active.
I
imagine they would chronicle everything, but...
Well, you know what's ironic about that is there are old newsreels of them in the newsreel archive, but we don't have any home movies. Isn't that wild?
Although I will tell our listeners that if you get Swissy Kurtz's book, there are a lot of photos in there of herself and her family, and they're really high quality. They're very good photographs.
The photos are amazing, aren't they? I have to say, I just think the photos blow me away. They really do.
So our final question for the delightful, marvelous Swissy Kurtz is, what are your hopes for the next decade ahead in your life?
I hope to keep growing and to keep curious and to stay in the game and on the train and active and involved and engaged. And I hope to find a life companion.
Oh?
Yeah.
Oh, well, are you on Match.com?
This is not going to work out between us.
It's so sad. So, although I do have children, and if you wait another 10 years, some of them will be eligible.
Well, I bet they're worth waiting for, too.
Oh, nearly all of them are circumcised, so it's very... The girls too. But let me ask you: Are you, if you are looking, you have to be. You're a proactive kind of person. When you do a Match.com, when you do a J-Date.
No, I don't look. I don't think in those terms. That's the problem. I don't put it out there. You know what I mean?
All right. Well, you know, if there are actors listening, and then, you know, good-looking middle-aged older men, or younger men. Actually, I shouldn't be prejudiced that way. You couldn't do better than the talented, lovely, delightful, funny Swoosie Kurtz, who has been such a delight with us in the neighborhood. All I can do is wish you all the things that you just wished on yourself for many years to come.
Oh, thank you so much, Rabbi Saul. You've been great. I've loved talking to you.
Likewise, my dear. Shalom to you and wonderful things ahead.
Thank you so much, and you too.
Shalom.